And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
But you're nothing until you do something for somebody else.
In honor of Black History Month.
Black History Month.
My story begins with my mother and father, Bernie and Willie McGinnis. They migrated to Indiana from Hoppersville, Alabama, looking for a better opportunity for their family. It's hard growing up in Indiana and not falling in love with the game of basketball. The year was 1956. I was 6 years old. Two events would change my life forever.
We had our first television set.
And I got to watch the nation's first all-black team compete for Indiana High School State Championship. That night, I was introduced to a young man who became not only my hero, but for every kid in our community's hero. His name was Oscar Palmer Robinson. Big O. He played for Christoph's Attucks High School, and he won the state championship for the second time in 1956. The 1956 team was the first team to go undefeated and win a championship since that tournament began in 1911. And I can't tell you the pride we felt in our community.
Yeah, that's right.
The next day was a Sunday, and it seems as though every boy in our neighborhood was out shooting buckets.
We all wanted to be like the Big O.
He inspired me, as well as many others in our state, to play this game, and I want to thank him for
Big
that.
Big O. 13
years later, in 1969, I was part of the second team in Indiana high school history to go undefeated and win a state championship.
George Washington High School.
I was very fortunate to be named Mr. Basketball that year in 1969.
And we fielded
the all-star team of our best seniors from Indiana against a team from Kentucky.
It's a game that's been going on for a lot of years.
We played two games, one in Indiana and one in Kentucky. The first game, I had 23 points and 14 rebounds. I didn't think that was too bad. One of the Kentucky players was not impressed with the game I had, so I didn't want to leave a bad impression on him. So the next week I had 53 points and 30 rebounds.
I rode back to
Indianapolis with my parents, and my dad, he came looking for a better life. He was such a hard-working guy. And he got to see a lot of my games. He worked construction during the day and a factory during the night.
But that night, he told me how proud he was of me.
One of the few times he ever told me that.
That was one of the best feelings I ever had.
But tragically, 9 days later,
he was killed in a construction accident.
That All-Star game was the last game he saw me play. So maybe it was God's will that I had the game that I did. I was honored to attend the great University of Indiana to play for Coach Lou Watson.
I became the first sophomore in Big Ten history to lead the league in scoring and rebounding.
I enjoyed my time there, but our family was struggling financially. My mother
and I had a chance to sign with the Indiana Pacers.
I did. I took all of my $15,000 signing bonus and put it down on a down payment on my mother's house that she still lives in to this day.
Yeah.
And so that leads me to you, Spencer Haywood. You were a big reason why I was able to do that. We watched you
lead that 1968 Olympic team.
And it was incredible. We had never seen anything like you, my man.
Coach Bobby Slick Leonard.
We just call him Slick. I couldn't have picked a better team to have gone to than the Pacers to start off my professional career. You've been like a father figure to me, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate, man, everything you've done for me. My best friend, I can come and talk to you during good times and bad times. You've always given me good information. I love you for that. You know, Slick always had a sense of community.
He instilled it in all of his players.
So I'll never forget my rookie year. First meeting we had, he called the meeting and he said, "Look, I don't care how good any of you think you are." He said, "But you're nothing until you do something for somebody else." I've never forgotten that.
Like my real father, Slick, he taught all of us to be tough,
but you also taught us to be compassionate. And I'd also like to thank all the fans who supported me throughout the years. But most of all, thank you, basketball. Thank you.
In honor of Black History Month.
Black History.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show, Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to Tampering.
We're this beautiful game of basketball that we all love and talk about every single day.
With Sam Panic.
To be able to bring people together.
What do you do, baby?
Reportedly at the center of an NBA investigation
into tampering accusations.
And the message to executives in the league is
stop talking about players on other teams.
What did I do?
The charges filed.
Impermissible contact.
Was it right or wrong?
Tampering charges are really difficult to prove.
You know me, I talk.
Kind of awkward to even talk about it. I can't even mention teams anymore.
Ask me what I like to play with Kevin Durant.
The trial you want with tampering.
They're always ahead of the rules.
It's not rocket science.
Everybody, we don't think I have tampered with the guys.
I didn't tamper. I'm just telling you what happened. I'm just telling you what happened.
Hello and welcome to the Tampering Podcast. I'm Sam Amick, NBA national writer at The Athletic, here with the one and only Anthony Slater on the West Coast. Slater, we're going to get to you in a minute, brother, but we have a special guest today, a guy who I just got to own it, man. I don't even know if we've had him on the show before. We definitely should have, because there is always stuff happening in Philly. We got the great Rich Hoffman, Sixers beat writer at The Athletic. Rich, what's up, sir?
Sam, what is up, my friend? Yeah, I don't think I've been on. I think I've been on every one of the other daily Athletic NBA show.
It's
like I'm hitting the triple crown now. You know?
Well, this is it. Now that the Sixers have officially, I shouldn't say officially, but seem to have tampered quite a bit, he should probably be on
exactly.
The tampering
pod. Damn. Hey, it's Slater. We're exactly. Trying to get Daryl Morey on this pod. We don't need to make the ask any
just
tougher.
Kidding.
My goodness. I love how when I went to introduce you, Rich, I'm just going to be real. Like, the guilt washed over me as the reality kind of occurred to me that we haven't had Rich on here. My goodness, I don't know why that hasn't happened. But happy to have you, man. The listeners can probably guess where our focus is going to be today. The dust has settled after a insane NBA trade deadline on Thursday. There was obviously a ton of action all over the league, but front and center, and the thing that we've been talking about for so long and heated up at the end, the James Harden, Ben Simmons trade. We're going to dive deep on it. We're also going to try to reassess the East in the context of that trade. Rich doesn't have a ton of time. He's got to bounce to Sixers practice in a minute. So we want to make good use of him being here. But on the back end, we will also talk some Western Conference, a little bit of Lakers and Warriors. Slater and I were at that game on Saturday. So we will make the rounds. But Rich, I guess let's start with the macro. You know, you had written leading up to this trade, kind of like I had as well, that this was a deal that for the Sixers' purposes needed to happen now versus the summer. That's all well and good. That was your perspective. But what was your level of surprise when this thing actually did go down?
I would say, compared to maybe a couple weeks ago, Sam, I was a little bit surprised, but the noise just kept building and building and building to the point where Thursday, it just seemed like an inevitability for both teams. Like, are you going to ruin your season for both teams? It was just such a unique trade in that aspect. And yeah, I think one of the things I kept hearing from, you know, other teams, you know, was the idea that Daryl Morey doesn't want to lose a trade. And I do think, like, in this case, if you look at how this trade ultimately ended, like, the Sixers gave up more stuff than they got back in this trade.
I think you can say they lost the trade. You know what I mean? Like, in a vacuum, I think they lost the trade.
Yeah.
That's fair.
And I think that proved to be wrong, that idea of Daryl Morey, because the ultimate thing is, do you get the star? I just want the star. I'm going to trade Ben Simmons for the star. And that's what
ultimately
he'll
lose a trade for James Harden.
Yes. Yeah. And that's why, I guess, you know, grading the trade right away, there are some issues with that. You know, if the Sixers end up winning a championship from this trade, they probably will have won it, just like the Bucks did with the Jrue Holiday going all in last year as well. Yeah. So I would say, you know, it just kept building and building over the last couple of weeks. And, you know, once James Harden had that game in Sacramento too, where he did not really try, I guess that's kind of putting it politely in that aspect. It just, I think that's when my antennas kind of went up right away. And it just felt like it built up to where Thursday those teams had to make a deal.
Slater, thoughts?
Yeah, I'm just, you know, now that, you know, you mentioned being in the aftermath, and I'm less interested in like the mechanics of how it went down and more interested in like, how does this work? You know, when do you expect James Harden to play? And when he does play, do you think it's going to be a clean, like, you know, fantastic 1-2 fit that you would think a guard and a big man would have? Or is the fact that Embiid, you know, operates a lot of times, you know, in guard areas and obviously is more on ball than you know, like a Shaq type center would be. Do you expect there maybe to be some kind of uncomfortable offensive issues?
So to your first question, I don't think they know yet if he's going to play. They have two games until the All-Star break. They're two pretty important games, though. Like, the East is all jumbled together. They're playing the Celtics tomorrow night. The Celtics have won a million games in a row at home. And then they're playing the Milwaukee Bucks in that last game. I mean, it would be nice to have him. Like, he's been in Philadelphia for a couple of days now. Like, you would think so. But, you know, whether it's the hamstring injury, which I know some people, you know, I put that in air quotes, you know, was that really real?
Tightness.
A lot of people, but most notably LeBron James on that epic TNT telecast where he is he healthy? Is James healthy? I don't know if he's healthy. I thought he was hurt. Yeah.
That was Charles Barkley at his finest. Yeah. Doing that. So can they get him into the games? I mean, I think it would be certainly helpful, but no straight answer on that yet. If not, he has a whole All-Star break, I guess, to get acclimated. It'll be interesting. You know, if he misses these games, will he even play in the All-Star game? As your second question, that's kind of the most interesting on-court fit story, I think, in the NBA right now, because you're right that it's not the easiest fit in the world. You know, James Harden in his career, when he's been at his best, he's had a spread floor and he's had a center that'll just screen for him and dunk and catch lobs. Joel Embiid is, I mean, it's crazy how good he's playing. Like, he's good at literally everything. The one thing he is not good at is like jumping way above the cylinder to dunk. He has said that. He's like, I'm not that type of explosive athlete. I'm going to get hurt doing that stuff. So that's not going to happen. The Sixers spacing's like a little iffy too. And like you said too, like, I don't think Harden has ever played with a guy that you just dump the ball to the post to and like can actually create a really good shot. What type of off-ball player is he for this crew? So that's up to James Harden and Doc Rivers to figure it out. I think there will be some level of clunkiness, but ultimately, like, Joel Embiid, he had Jimmy Butler for about half a year, and that was pretty good come playoff time, but he's never had a guy as talented as Harden on the perimeter. And really, I don't think it's close, almost, like a guy who can create offense and kind of take this insane load he's been carrying this entire season off his shoulder. So that's the ultimate question, Slater. I think it's going to be clunky for a little while, but they're going to have to figure it out in what, 26 games?
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously willing to find their way through that clunkiness. You know, I kind of alluded to it earlier. The idea that Daryl would, and I'm with you, Slater, I don't want to look backwards too much, but the idea that Daryl would, quote unquote, lose a trade, you know, for somebody like Harden is obviously rooted in his just extreme love for this guy as a player. I mean, he famously said that he was a better scorer than Michael Jordan a couple of years ago.
Did you guys see the video of him like hugging him when he got off the plane? It was like,
oh yeah. It's like they had their own TikTok channel.
Is there a comparable like GM, executive and player relationship in history?
No way, right?
No. I mean, sure, if you go back to executive, I don't know. Phil Jackson and Michael.
Magic and Buss, like, maybe we're about to see it on this HBO show, but he gave him like a 25-year deal for something like that. I don't know.
Well, and even shoot, shameless plug for, you know, we have a piece on Magic on our site today, Magic and Jeannie Buss. Jeannie, even after everything that happened with Magic as an executive, she's in Bill's story, still talking about how they're extremely close and talk about the team currently. So yeah, that's a decent one. But the thing with Daryl, like, you're right, Rich, that he didn't, I am convinced, I'm in the crowd that he thought he did not want to lose a trade, but it was for anybody but James Harden. And if you go back to, I've said this on the pod before, you go back to the trade, you know, where he sent Chris Paul to OKC for Russell Westbrook, that was Daryl's cautionary tale, where he looks back on that and knows that he should have pushed back on Tillman Fertitta, pushed back on James Harden, and not done that deal. He did succumb to pressure in that situation, and it obviously was a terrible trade. But this is his guy, and it's his guy. He's also, I think, a realist where he knows, I mean, even though it's quote-unquote just an extra half season, like, it's his guy at 32 years old when he's not getting younger, and he needs to get James back into a special place where he can be that kind of player. In terms of the mechanics, some of the stuff you guys are talking about with the big, small mix, you know, give me a little bit of a flashback to the Rockets days when James and Dwight Howard were trying to figure it out. You know, I remember I went to Houston one time to do a piece on Dwight, and actually it involved, you know, I ended up going to his house and this kind of really involved access piece. And at that time, the friction was there between James and Dwight. And a big part of their problem was Dwight not getting enough touches in the paint, Dwight getting frustrated with the way that James played. And of all people, I remember Jerome Williams, remember the old Junkyard Dog,
sure,
was a buddy of Dwight's. And this one day in the locker room was almost like, seemed like he was almost playing like a middleman role between James and Dwight, like trying to talk to James about, man, just give him a couple touches and he'll chill a little bit. So like that, you know, that element is as old as time when it comes to the game. Kobe, Shaq, go all the way down the line. It's going to be somewhat clunky, but you know, the alternative, you know, Joel trying to take on the world, was never going to lead to a title.
No.
And it's been fun to watch. And I certainly hope that we don't suddenly see Joel floating out to the 3-point line a lot more like he did in his earlier years. But I do think it's got the potential to be really great.
Well, and that was the fundamental problem with this team. I mean, you're right in that not having Ben Simmons there the entire year did free Joel for the past, I'm going to say 2 months, to just play at a level that he has never
just
played.
Just fall out, yeah.
And it's crazy. But when you projected ahead to the playoffs, I mean, that team was drawing dead. No Ben Simmons. They had no chance whatsoever. And we can argue, like, you know, do they really have like an awesome chance to win a championship this year, especially because it's going to be a little bit clunky with those guys? You know, I think it's going to be a little bit hard. But first off, it's just good to have a team that you're not completely wasting his season. Like, you are actually giving him a chance. This is his reward for having this great season. Now you have a chance to win. And I would say the other benefit that I see from having James in this season is that they can kind of evaluate how those two fit together. And maybe look this offseason to, okay, this is what we need to do to put around these guys. Because they have, you know, it's not, you look at their bench, it's not like a murderer's row of players. It's a lot of like one-way guys. And they just lost, you know, they lost Seth Curry and Andre Drummond, who I think you do that deal for James Harden for sure. But like, who were two guys who were in their rotation and contributing to them in different ways. So that's kind of the other benefit I see from it too.
Doc Rivers has coached a bunch of personalities, right? I mean, you would think that's somewhat of a strength of his, although, you know, the Lob City Clippers, I mean, that's what derailed them, was like, you know, I guess personality clashes. Yeah. So just, I'm just curious your thoughts on like Doc's part in all this and maybe the pressure on him heading into the playoffs to, you know, schematically solve this, but also obviously like personality wise solve this after also trading his son-in-law. That was, you know, interesting, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just so weird. So bizarre that, you know, he had to tell his daughter like, yeah, your son is definitely, or your husband is definitely going to be in the trade. Like that's going to happen. At this point, I think Doc, there is a lot of pressure on him in the last month or so. I think, you know, we'll see behind the scenes, you know, what is Doc and Daryl's relationship like? Like, they kind of came here. They weren't a package deal. They came here pretty much at the same time, but they were on different paths. Like, Doc came here and he was hired by kind of Elton Brand and the ownership. And at the same time, they were getting Daryl Morey. You know, they were convincing him after he left Houston, okay, this is, we want you here to come in on top of all of these things. Now, they have a shared history. I frankly think they have worked pretty well over the last couple of years, but that's, you know, there's a lot of pressure on him. The Sixers paid Doc Rivers a lot of money in the middle of the pandemic, just like they paid Daryl Morey a lot of money. And now he has a team that is capable of winning it. Like, I think for as much grief as Doc gets about those comments about Ben Simmons after the season last year, I personally don't think like that team could have won at all just because of how flawed it was on the perimeter now. You have James Harden now, and like, he, if he's healthy and good, like, I think Doc, he's going to have to, you're right, he's going to have to manage the personalities, which is, you know, he has experience doing, but it hasn't always gone well, I would say. It's an interesting case with him. And I kind of wonder, you know, if this does not work this season and Doc can't figure it out, I'm not like predicting he's going to get fired or anything like that right away. But I do think like he would be the natural person you would look at for sure.
Well, I think in terms of the pressure, as always, you know, it's always there to varying degrees for every team. And then it just moves depending on the context of each person's circumstance, right? So it's now on Doc. I think it's been alleviated for Daryl.
Yep.
And that's one thing where I think there was a good amount of pressure on Daryl. You know, I don't have total clarity on this, but I am really interested in the dynamic relating to Daryl and the Sixers franchise, you know, because I was close to the Rockets back when he was doing his thing out there. And it's like, my goodness, the idea that, you know, he leaves Houston at the time, says that he's going to just take a breather and spend more time with his family, winds up in Philly a few weeks later. There were certainly folks on the Ben Simmons side who believed that, like, you know, the Sixers' motive for going to chase down Daryl Morey was, like, began with James Harden and ended with James Harden. And when he couldn't get that trade over the finish line last summer, then, you know, the question became like, well, what, and this is, again, outside voices saying, well, what good are you to us? You didn't get the guy. And my gosh, he just keeps chasing it. And he eventually gets it. So I think the pressure comes off of Daryl, and we'll never know, you know, if he had completely kind of shot an air ball on this Ben Simmons trade, what that might've looked like. But now with Doc, I mean, you've already seen, I don't truthfully know the root of this, Rich, and you could probably tell me from the Philly local media side, but it does seem like there's already media chatter about the Mike D'Antoni possibility and things like that. And it's natural for people to wonder because, you know, Daryl had come over, Tad Brown, the former Rockets CEO, you know, now the Sixers and Devils CEO is over in Philly. All these familiar faces. And you know why that matters beyond the obvious of just connecting dots is that James Harden greatly enjoyed like the, what you might argue is unprecedented level of like organizational freedom that he had in Houston, where as long as he performed, James could just be James. He could jump on a private jet and, you know, and go party somewhere else over the weekend, come back in time for tip off, do your thing. You know, they weren't all over him about his conditioning. They weren't, I mean, they just let him live as long as he could come out and drop 50. And that might not be the healthiest dynamic, but it's what he enjoyed. And it feels like that's partly what he chased in Philly and that he might expect. I know I'm throwing a few different angles at you there, but like, let's go down the road of James and the organizational culture, because, you know, how does Joel Embiid potentially fit or feel rather, you know, if James is carrying himself in the kind of way where, man, I kind of took what I had in Houston and I moved it over to Philly. You know, like how do those two guys as superstars share the same oxygen with that kind of history?
Well, and I think that's especially a good question because this year, like Joel has taken on the face of the franchise thing more than he has in the past. Like, sure, he's been their best player for forever, for pretty much since he stepped on the court. But I think he started to take the other stuff seriously, down to like being completely lockstep with Daryl Morey on this Ben Simmons, you know, are we going to trade this guy this year? Will it be okay if we wait until the summer? All of those things. Like he's been in, I wouldn't say involved with it, but he's been certainly clued in on a lot of those things. And yeah, he's almost been, it's been described to me like an extension of Daryl Morey. They have a pretty good relationship, I would say. So James Harden is walking into a situation, like you said, you know, I'm just taking, you know, what you've said. And I think a lot of people have kind of reported on the organizational freedom that he had in Houston. I mean, this is not his team. Like he's walking in, he is the number two at this point. And, you know, I don't think the Sixers are a, you know, they're not like a Miami Heat type of organization where, you know, the franchise is above all, and there are certain benchmarks you have to make. That said, like, it'll be interesting to see now that he is not the guy and how he's dealing with it. And I think you mentioned with the Joel Embiid and Mike D'Antoni, if you remember, Mike D'Antoni was a coach for the Sixers during the process years, and Joel Embiid was not playing during that time, but he was interacting with him. Like I remember him, you know, when he was sitting out those, I think it was the second of those 2 years when he had the foot surgeries. He was, yeah, he knew Mike D'Antoni. And I remember kind of when the Rockets would play the Sixers, he would mention him, you know, pretty freely. So that's something certainly to keep in the back of your mind for that. But yeah, like just how does James Harden mesh with these guys? Like as much as Philadelphia got angry with Ben Simmons sitting out the entire year, like James Harden, he just quit on the Nets. You know, I don't want to like sugarcoat that, you know, he wanted out, and that's the second time he's done that over the past couple of years. So, you know, what happened?
The only caveat I'll give him, and then I'm going to boot you from the pod because I see the time at 20. I don't want you to stress having to get to practice, but the only caveat I will give him on this one, and bear in mind, I mean, I wrote some critical stuff just the other day about James, is just the Kyrie component is so unique. Like, the idea that, you know, this is not what he signed up for in Brooklyn, that Kyrie obviously wouldn't take the shot, was now gone half the time. Kevin gets hurt. Now, that's just basketball. People get hurt. But there is a part of me, it doesn't take him off the hook by any means for, you know, the idea that two teams in 13 months, you can't run from that, that you did, you know, kind of pout your way out the door twice in a really short span of time. But the Kyrie thing puts a lot of culpability at his feet, too.
Yep. And I think that's certainly understandable from Harden's standpoint, because he went to Brooklyn to be a part of something that was bigger than he had in Houston, to be a part of a team. And he was, I mean, he was playing with a bunch of kind of second round picks and guys who weren't ready to play with him. I guess last thought on Embiid, and I'll say this, I think he has gotten to the point of his career at 27 years old where I think he realizes, like, hey, we've made so many organizational mistakes over the past few years. Nothing has ever gone perfect. Like, just give me a chance to win. And I think he realizes with Harden, like, he's going into this with eyes wide open, like, hey, this guy, he's as talented as any player as I've had, but he certainly has some issues that we're going to have to iron out both on the court and some questions off the court. Like, is he going to buy in to his team? I think the other thing we're not going to talk about here, but just defensively, like, you got to start playing it, Harden. That would be the other aspect of it. But I think he's just grateful that, like, he has a guy who at the end of games, like, he doesn't have to be the only person to create his own shot. And I think he has had enough rough experiences both on the court and off the court to appreciate that he just needs a chance to compete. And he's at that point now.
No question. Rich, thank you so much, man. I know it wasn't easy to join us. We appreciate you. Keep kicking butt out there. And it'll be fun to read you down the home stretch of the season with this new crew. Thanks, brother.
All right. See you guys.
Be good.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
All right, Slater, let's unpack some of that stuff before we go a little bit macro on the East. I mean, to cut to the chase in terms of kind of handicapping this thing, like, you know, do you think it's going to work? And I guess that would mean, you know, by definition, I'm talking about, you know, Philly being in the finals, you know, something on of that level. Do you think it's going to work?
Well, I mean, pretty much every point we were, you know, Rich was just discussing, and it also depended on Harden, like, just how does he look? How is he playing? What condition is he in? You know, can he physically stay healthy enough? Because remember, he went to Brooklyn last season and it did go well. He was like in the MVP conversation when KD had to miss a bunch of time because he got himself in shape. And he was basically coming in the same situation from Houston, right? You know, remember the conditioning issues he was having there? It took him, what, maybe 1-2 weeks, and he looked like his old self. So, you know, and part of that was because Durant was off the court. I think Kyrie was in and out of the lineup at that point, and he kind of got to play James Harden basketball. So it's going to be a different environment. You mentioned – were they like posting Dwight Howard in Houston? Like, for some reason, it's like hard for me to even remember the Dwight Howard, you know, Harden era. But like, was Dwight a featured offensive player still then?
He wanted to be more. Yeah, no, I mean, when he went there, it was a 1-2 combo. I mean, Dwight was trying to salvage what hadn't worked with the Lakers, but he still saw himself as, you know, a big time featured free agent big and wanted to be down on the block. I mean, you know how it is. The earlier first half of Dwight's career, you know, he wanted to be like Shaq, and he just wasn't. But James wanted him to basically be Clint Capella, yeah, which is why Dwight eventually lost his job to Clint Capella.
I mean, you're almost, to me, it's very, you know, it's opposite what's about to happen here, where you know, James is the more aged, you know, offensive piece, and like Embiid's probably the more efficient hub at this point. And not that Embiid wants James Harden to turn into, you know, Seth Curry basically or something, but you know, it's James Harden basically took that situation over, and it made sense at the time, right? Like, yeah, you should just like play James Harden basketball and like Dwight Howard should just kind of be like a rim running, like rebounder. That's not what Joel Embiid should be. So they got to figure that concoction out. But also, like, James Harden, I mean, he mentioned it, he's got to play good basketball. And like, that solves a lot of issues and alleviates a lot of pressure. It makes Daryl Morey look good for, you know, holding off for the trade. It would make Doc Rivers, not feel like he's on the hot seat. It would probably allow James Harden to live how he wants to live, right? You know, part of the reason he could do that in Houston is because of how well he was playing. You lose grip of that power if you don't play well, and especially in Philadelphia. That's the other, you know, aspect of all this. The weird thing about Brooklyn, they don't have a rabid fan base. Like, while this is all going down, he wasn't feeling the pressure that, like, clearly sent Ben Simmons out of town. Maybe Ben Simmons will enjoy that aspect of the Brooklyn fan base. But Phil, you know, James Harden, they're going to you know, probably give him a standing ovation when he's announced in starting lineups the first time. But 2 weeks from now, if he's struggling, you know what that Philly market is going to do.
So the East is loaded. We know as much, you know what I mean? So let's try to kind of keep looking at the Sixers through the filter of the rest of the East. You know, I'm looking at it here, and as we record on Monday, I know I feel like we say this every year, maybe got some recency bias, but to be this late in the season and have, in either conference and have five teams separated by 2.5 games like they are in the East. You got Miami up top right now, the Bulls one game back, the Cavs 2 games back, the Bucks also 2 games back, the Sixers 2.5, the Celtics, who have obviously been on a roll lately, won 9 of their last 10, are 4.5 back. And even the Raptors, I should just go all the way to the 7th spot. You're talking 5 games. Get all the way down to Toronto, and then there's your Brooklyn Nets.
You know, Toronto's 5 games back of the 1, and they're the 7th seed in the East. Memphis is 7 back. That's 2 more games back, and they're the 3rd seed in the West. I mean, the Warriors are at 2. They're 4.5 back. So the Warriors are basically as, you know, far away from Phoenix at the 2 as Boston is, of the 1 seed, and they're at the 6 right now. So, yeah, I mean, it's clumped. But, you know, generally your question is...
But post-trade deadline, who jumps out at you? You know, the Bucks, kind of under the radar, adding Serge Ibaka, I think, is helpful. The Brook Lopez thing obviously has been an issue all year long and is still not clear. But Serge has actually looked pretty good recently, you know, and I think he's going to help. The Cavs, obviously, surprise story of the season. The Bulls now dealing with a Zach LaVine injury that is going to set them back a bit. But, you know, who's running the East in this post trade deadline landscape if you're handicapping it?
I think Milwaukee is the known commodity. They'd probably be my slight favorite just because, to me, in a playoff setting, we know what they're going to be essentially. I mean, obviously, they do have to figure out, can they get anything from Brook Lopez and what can Ibaka give them? But they're known. I need to see Harden and Embiid on the court before we know like what kind of playoff threat they're going to be. And then, you know, probably even weirder is going to be the mix in Brooklyn. And how does that actually look like on the court? What does it look like on the court, I should say? But I think those are my three. And then I'd probably have Miami, you know, right under there. I don't think Miami's ceiling is quite what Brooklyn and Philadelphia's ceiling could be, but we just haven't seen it yet. And then beyond that, like, I think Cleveland's still a player away and probably a year or two away. Chicago, nice story. I don't consider them in that top tier. Boston's probably been the hottest team in the league lately, but, I'm not in the tier of the top three that I would consider.
Yeah, I mean, Boston, I love, you know, what's got me kind of re-energized is these second half storylines. And obviously it's not second half. We're 2/3 of the way in. But the stuff that is going to get your curiosity, you know, peaked even more than before because things have changed. And the Celtics getting Derek White, Ime Udoka figuring things out as a coach, that actually becoming, you know, that group becoming a good squad again when we, you know, for years now, we've been wondering Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Marcus Smart, do they keep it together? What do they do? I like the Derek White addition. And even though offensively they're going to continue to be ISO heavy and not that much fun to watch, at least in terms of, you know, the beautiful Warrior style
not
ball
even
movement.
Jason Tatum's
that you see all
kid
the time.
Is trying to watch Jason Tatum. You see that from yesterday?
No, what I missed.
You got to go online. People were loving it. You know, Tatum scoring whatever 34. He had a great game. It was that before the Super Bowl, like ABC morning game. Tatum, like, you know, hits a three in the mid fourth to have 34. He's having this great second half. And they pan to his kid sitting courtside and he's like, you know, watching something on his phone, probably watching like a cartoon or something. He's not even paying attention.
Listen, he don't, man, like ISO ball. As a father of 15 and 12 year olds, that's just 2022. That's all that is. True. I could be doing jumbo jacks in front of my kids and they wouldn't look up. I mean, here on my side with the East, I'm with you 100%. If you're just saying, you know, which squad do you feel most comfortable rolling with? I mean, those Bucks, man, they're special. And I still have fresh memories of covering them in the championship run. So, you know, I'm probably going with the Bucks, but from there, it's a crapshoot. And before we head out west, I do think we should spend a few quick minutes diving a little more into the Brooklyn side of this thing. Not only just the trade, but, you know, where they take it all from here. You talk about just one of the most unique landscapes for any quote-unquote contender, Slater, that I can ever remember, where we are legitimately talking about a team that is currently in eighth place in the East, and nobody even bats an eye at the prospect of still calling them title contenders this year. 11
straight losses right now.
Oh, yeah, 11 straight losses. Shouldn't we be kind of sending them off to pasture? But we're not, because of the trade, because of the uncertainty of Kyrie's status, that if things changed in New York and he could suddenly play home games, that's a game changer. The Kevin Durant injury, you know, my goodness, he's sending off concerning kind of vibes in his TNT interview that he did. So he'll be out for a while still. But the if of, you know, if they get Kevin, Kyrie, and Ben out there, they could still run the table if it happens at the right time. I think it's still real. And that's because talent rules all in the NBA and pro sports. And it probably won't happen. I'm not putting my, you know, we're not gambling here, but putting my money on that team. But I think it could happen. But what do you think of the Brooklyn side?
Man, it could get dicey in the next few weeks. Kyrie, there, two other next three road games are at Knicks and at Toronto. Can't play in either of those. So he can only play, I think I'm looking like, in one of their next eight games. Ben Simmons, when will we see him? I assume not till post All-Star break. And he'll need some type of, you know, beyond obviously the mental health stuff. And he hasn't played basketball in a while. I'm assuming he's going to need, like, you know, somewhat of a ramp up period just to get his NBA conditioning. You're mentioning Durant. Who knows when we'll see him again? They've lost 11 in a row. They've clearly shown to not have the type of team that can win games when those guys aren't on the court. So this could get to, like, what, like, you know, 17 out of 18, you know, they could lose. And it's very possible that they're going to have to be trying to play themselves in through the play-in. And, you know,
let's be real. They could fall out. They really could. I mean, Washington is 3.5 back in the 11. Now the Wizards don't have Beal. You know, Porzingis isn't even ready to play after that trade. So not likely. You know, could the Knicks win some games? The Pacers could win. Oh, never mind. I take it back. They're 18.5 back. So really, your New York Knickerbockers are probably, you know, the only threat to knocking Brooklyn out. But the idea that they got to make sure they don't even fall out of the play-in is crazy.
Yeah. But I do think if you do see Durant by early March, I think I saw the number there, something like 24-12 with Durant in the lineup this season. And it's not like he's had, you know, a bunch. It's not like, you know, Kyrie's barely been available when he was there. Harden wasn't good, really. He wins you games. So if Durant shows back up, they're going to get into the playoffs. Once they get there, to me, I just want to see him and Ben Simmons and no center on the court. I'm just so curious about, like, you know, that potential devastating, like, small ball lineup. And does it work, or does it just sound good in theory, in like 2022 theory? How does Ben Simmons look? I mean, that's maybe what, you know, we mentioned the Harden and Embiid mix. I'd say the second biggest question down the stretch in the East is, like, is Ben Simmons still, you know, near defensive player of the year?
All NBA yeah. player. Yeah.
Because if he is.
Well, your small ball question is interesting because, you know, on one of our sister pods, I think this was on Nerder, that Seth Partnow, obviously deep roots in Milwaukee, still lives in Milwaukee, had talked about the Simmons small ball idea and had memories of Ben, you know, getting destroyed by Giannis when Philly had kind of gone that route. And Giannis, who's not normally a trash talker, you know, kind of, you know, basically just kind of mocking Ben for him being too small. So in the East, you know, I don't know, is the runway there in today's East to allow them to take advantage of that small ball lineup like your Warriors did back in the day when they started doing that with Draymond? When you're running into Joel Embiid, when you're running into Giannis, it might be a little tougher to do in that context.
I wouldn't mind seeing them try in a Sixers-Nets series, trying to play small ball against Embiid and, you know, maybe even some Simmons guarding Embiid in Philadelphia. I mean, you know, some potential storylines. We just need the matchups to actually, you know, line up and clash.
It takes a lot for me to get on a plane and go all the way east, but you better believe I'm going to be, you know, maybe calling our guy Joe Varden and saying, hey, can you keep a seat warm next to you on press row on the eastern side of the playoffs just to see, you know, a potential Sixers-Nets matchup? Because we're getting ahead of ourselves, but the idea of Ben, you know, given the part that the Sixers fans played and his desire not to play there, and it was fairly significant that, you know, because it all started with the team in his eyes giving up on him and in his eyes throwing him under the bus. But that's all, none of that matters if it's not gaslighting the fans, which is what he thinks they did. And so, you know, the prospect of him walking out onto the court in that building in a Nets jersey and the reaction that would ensue would be incredible.
March 10th, I mean, you know, that's still, you know, 3-4 weeks from now. Yeah. I assume he'll be playing. Kyrie can play in that game because it's in Philadelphia. Durant probably back by then. Harden and Embiid, I assume, will have got some time together. You know, who knows in the modern NBA in the regular season how many guys will and won't be available. I mean, that could easily, if Ben Simmons isn't trying to see Philly fans that night, that could be a, you know, hamstring tightness for him or something like that. But, you know, if I'm Brooklyn, I'd want him to get that out of the way before a potential playoff matchup, right? Like, let the crowd do their, basically the Durant cupcake game.
See how bad the jitters are.
It helps. Yeah. In retrospect, I always remember talking to the Warriors post Durant going to Oklahoma City in that first season in the cupcake game that's memorable. And like that did galvanize them together. And, you know, they won the game. Durant scored 30. Draymond and Steph Curry postgame are wearing cupcake shirts because they turned it into a joke, basically. And, you know, the Warriors are good at that. But that really helped them, I thought, chemistry-wise, that first season when it was as good as it had ever been with Durant and the Warriors. So, you know, if Brooklyn's able to go into Philly that night, let Ben absorb that. And, you know, Durant, who will be there, presumably knows that feeling and maybe try to help him, guide him through that. That could be a good moment for them. I don't know. We're just looking ahead a little bit.
Man, you're looking at layers, but those are all very good points. All right, on the other side of this last break, let's talk a little bit of Western Conference post-trade deadline. We went to that Lakers-Warriors game on Saturday.
Kings.
And Slater wants to talk Kings, and you know I can never say no to that. All right, we will be right back.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, and show you hidden allies so that you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/NBAshow23. That's linkedin.com/NBAshow23 for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/NBAshow23 and get started. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, Slater, let's talk Western Conference. We had a lot of moving parts on that side of the league's ledger as well. You and I go to Lakers-Warriors on Saturday. You were kind enough to give me a ride, so we got some time to chop it up in the car. You know, quick takeaways on my side. That particular game is interesting because you're talking about the, you know, near the top of the West and near the bottom of the West in the playoff picture. Two teams with a ton of talent on the floor. And the surprising part, of course, was, and not that we're trying to recap the game, but that, you know, that the Lakers played, you know, much better than they had in really weeks, still didn't win the game. But, you know, and the Warriors probably played below their normal level, but good ball game. And for me on the Lakers side, I'm going to go ahead and sound like the most naive media member out there and just say it did kind of make me wonder, can they show a pulse down the stretch here? Russell Westbrook played some pretty controlled, effective basketball. They all talked at length about the kind of in the locker room calm and, you know, peace of mind that came with getting past the trade deadline to a degree that it surprised me a little bit, because other than, you know, kind of rumors on the edge around Russell Westbrook and then Talen Horton Tucker and Kendrick Nunn, who's not even playing, you know, it wasn't like, you know, half the roster was believed to be available for the Lakers, but it seemed like there was some level of anxiety internally that they think that they're going to be better off now that is gone. We'll see if that was just a one night thing. I think they play at Utah on Wednesday. But what did you see out of the purple and gold?
Well, if people want our fuller thoughts, they can subscribe to the Warriors Plus Minus podcast. you gave me a perfect chance to plug Indeed. That one. It was kind of fascinating how it played out, where like the problem in that game was LeBron down the stretch, right? He was 1-10 in the fourth. He missed the free throw to potentially tie it, but we know, you know, wider scope, that is the least of their problems. It isn't LeBron. So, you know, maybe Russell Westbrook's gaining a little bit of momentum, maybe him getting through the trade deadline and understanding he, you know, because if Russell Westbrook gets traded from the Lakers at the deadline, particularly if it's to Houston, like, he's not going to go play in Houston, right? I mean, that's a buyout scenario. And then, you know, you're starting to worry and wonder where Russell Westbrook's next destination is and how long he's in the league, basically. And
it's a legacy stain, you know, big time.
So I, you know, if I was him, I would have been very concerned about that in that week lead up. And he's through that now. He knows he's there the rest of the season. At this point, they have to commit to the idea of him helping. And I thought to that point,
real quick, I'm going to interject. And I might write some of this next or later in the week, but I asked AD after the game about these dynamics, and he had a really good answer about why, from a human standpoint, it did matter to them to get past the deadline. But as he said this in the press conference, he was sitting next to Russ, and I had asked the question of both of them. And when Anthony was done with what I appreciated was a really good answer, they were about to walk off the stage, and I just kind of, you know, I still had the mic in my hand, and I said, Russ, any thoughts? And you know, Russ, not normally, I mean, he's had some somewhat quote unquote charming media moments.
He's charmed
year.
You all and season.
He cracked me up, man. He literally winked. He winked and he said, I agree. And it felt as if AD was basically speaking for Russ. You know, that was kind of my takeaway. So we'll see what that means. I mean, if they have a massive uptick, it's still, you know, we're not talking about them as title contenders anymore. But let's jump into the rest of the West. And just kind of get a sense of things. You know, Phoenix, to start with the squad that continues to get overlooked and is far and away the most dominant team in the NBA, adds a player in Torrey Craig who, you know, is going to help come playoff time. You get another wing defender, a guy who's been in their program before, and, you know, not a big move by any means, but it's pretty tough when you're that good to make moves around the margins. So credit to James Jones and that front office for adding Torrey. We can start there and move our way down. What jumped out?
I was actually the trade deadline day that night the Warriors played, or maybe it was the next day. Draymond Green was out on the court and not going through an intense workout because he's not yet ready to advance to that. But he was just chatty. I think partly because he wasn't playing, he wasn't like locking in for a game. And I would just talk to him for 10 minutes or so about the deadline, different moves, and he mentioned the Torrey Craig move because I was more talking, man, the East really shook up, but nothing really happened in the West. And he's like, Torrey Craig, it's good for Phoenix to add another wing defender. That's something to, and the fact that he noted that, I thought was
sure,
because that is who we're looking at as, the potential West Finals is Warriors. Suns. Yeah, the
Warriors are trying to keep up with them.
Yeah. And obviously the Warriors were silent at the deadline. That's not anything that seemed to bother him at all. But the fact that he mentioned the Torrey Craig move, and it's clearly somebody Phoenix believes can help them, because Torrey Craig was on their team last season and helped in a small dose role. But generally, everybody in the West to me remained pretty intact. And that was kind of the point I was making to him. Like, there's, to me, the landscape's the same out there, which includes,
except for Dallas, man. I mean, we don't have to spend too much time there, but I'm with our John Hollinger on that one. The more I looked at it, Spencer Dinwiddie has had a rough stretch in terms of finding his best self, in Brooklyn and Washington. And, the idea that, Porzingis had obviously been underwhelming and had not fit that role as Luka's co-star, and health had been a major problem, and I assume it played a big part in this decision. But that was a strange one.
Yeah, I meant more like the potential title landscape or conference championship landscape in the West didn't
alter. Gotcha.
And you could say Dallas lessened. It sounds like what you're basically saying, and I would look at Utah. That's the 4-5, right?
I actually thought for a minute that Dallas was a squad that might surge. You know what I mean? Especially when Luka started getting back to doing his Luka things. And obviously Dallas takes on that Davis Bertans contract too. I thought they took a step backward. It's a little bit like, and we'll keep it moving here, but the Sixers didn't want to put too much on Joel Embiid, right? It's that unofficial calculus of MVP caliber players that do special things, but you can't take it for granted and forget that it's a team game with 82 games, and you can't put too much on a guy. Like, this puts more on Luka, and I think has him now destined to have a third straight first round bow out in the playoffs potentially.
Yeah, but they're probably playing Utah, and you mentioned teams that just didn't make a leap at the deadline. I think we've thought all season, pre-Ingles injury, really even when we thought they were going to be a one or two seed, that Utah had to make the big splash at the deadline. Like, they had to try to push their team over the top somehow with this era that, might be shifting by the offseason with Danny Ainge now around. But they didn't. Right, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, that's the big move, I guess. And
Utah's not, I'll put it on wax and see if I end up looking stupid. Utah's not losing to Dallas in the first round. To me, Utah, if they got Donovan, if they got Rudy, they're fine in the earlier rounds. I think they've been sideways. They've had injury. The Ingles thing certainly hurts. But to me, Utah, they're 35-21. That's still a whole lot of negativity and a whole lot of noise around them. Yet here they are. Obviously, they're not in that top tier in the West, still a pretty damn good mark.
They won five in a row. And they look, I just mean generally, if we're talking about them getting over the hit, top, I just thought they needed to do something. I think people around the team generally felt that too. Like, this is an outsider.
Oh, yeah. No, we'll be talking about Utah. I mean, the front office changes. You got Danny Ainge with Justin Zanuck out there. You got, I think, Quinn Snyder always kind of reading the room and seeing what he thinks of where the whole group is going. The Donovan Mitchell, Rudy Gobert dynamic. They've been through a lot. They got a lot of battle scars. They still got a lot of talent. I don't see them winning the whole thing by any means, but they're going to be dangerous. Let's just cut to the chase later.
The play-in mix has changed. That's what's really was altered in the West. Here they come. They're hot.
Are we doing it? Are we doing it? Are we getting to your Kings?
Am I putting it, your prediction of the day was Utah would not lose in the first round of the Dallas Mavericks. My prediction of the day, the Sacramento Kings are going to surge into that 10th seed. They will be a play-in team.
Wow, there it is.
And if they can get to there 9, maybe they can leap the Lakers and get a golden one center, Lakers-Kings playing. I'll just say this. I mean, I think we could definitely discuss why maybe the Haliburton-Sabonis trade wasn't good for the long term. They look like they got a lot more life than they did.
And they have a big week. Yeah. They play Brooklyn and I think Chicago first.
Brooklyn. I believe Brooklyn tonight, actually. Is it
Brooklyn tonight? Okay. Well, by the time we'll see what happens there. You should be beating the Nets, you know, with nobody out there. Then again, 11 in a row creates a different energy. So maybe somebody on that Brooklyn squad finds a way to get a W. But it's two games. They beat Minnesota. They beat Washington. I was at the Minnesota game. And it's funny because it was fun to watch from the standpoint of, you know, and I've seen it countless times before, but post-trade deadline debuts, right, where you have prominent players who are in real time. Like, to Sabonis' credit, he wasted no time getting out on the floor with the Kings. But then to see them work out kind of their issues in real time when they haven't really even practiced together is always really interesting to watch. And so they are playing a fully stocked Timberwolves team. And at one point, I think they were down like 13. And you're kind of going, oh boy, this is going to be a bad debut. But Sabonis just keeps, you know, running to the rim, putting his hand up. He cracks me up, man. He's got that hand up more than anybody in the league. Like, he's like a 35-year-old pickup basketball player who just, you know, that dude who's always like, all right, give it to me. But he deserves it, and he's good. And he ended up functioning pretty well with De'Aaron Fox, who Slater,
That's what's the biggest thing that has happened since the deadline is he just looks rejuvenated, right? Because in the lead-up, with all the rumors he was in, he wasn't playing. Like, you know, he had this ankle injury that, you know, sounded like to you, he was the one that was kind of deactivating himself, essentially saying, ankle's not ready. Haliburton gets traded, which was a stamp of their going forward with De'Aaron Fox. And he shows back up, and at least these last two games, with an environment that is conducive to him, right, with a pick-and-roll partner, looks like the De'Aaron Fox of last season.
Yeah, he had a few possessions in that Minnesota game that I hadn't seen in months, if not since last season, where it was, you know, pedal to the metal on the break. You know, this is the guy that I remember chirping with Russell Westbrook a couple years ago about who was the fastest player in the league, had more of a chip on his shoulder. And when you talk to people about De'Aaron, first of all, the Kings made a very loud statement that they still believe in him, you know, and one particular line that was repeated to me multiple times was the idea that, you know, De'Aaron was 16th in the NBA in scoring last season, that they just, that one particular stat, they didn't want to forget that. You know what I mean? That at his best, he's an elite scorer, and you didn't want to let go of that. But competitiveness is something that frustrates, you know, Kings officials, Kings teammates when it comes to De'Aaron, that he will kind of come and go on that front. There's been games when somebody chirps enough that it finally gets under his skin or something happens with the refs and you will see that fire get lit and then he's on a different level, but it comes and goes. And, you know, he's not always diving to the floor for the loose ball. And yeah, it's only two games, but he did look different. And the one thing that I think also doesn't get talked about a lot in this trade is that it was also a statement about Davion Mitchell, because the fans were certainly upset that they lose Tyrese Haliburton. I've been in the camp that Tyrese is a very nice player, but, you know, people who don't live here, and I do, just don't understand how terrible the mood is among the fans. Like, it is as dire as you can find. You know, it's like, you know, Major League style from the old Cleveland Indians baseball movie back in the day. Like, it is a sad scene that they need to improve. And if it cost him Haliburton to get a two-time All-Star who they are optimistic about re-signing, that's great. But it also, to get to my initial point, it means that they believe in Davion Mitchell, and he's a guy that is going to have a massive role here.
Yeah, and, you know, they don't have much time left in this season, and again, we could probably discuss if all the dynamics weren't what you said, you know, with the fan base and this, you know, Vivek's desire to win now, this desperation to end the 15 season playoff drought. It's probably not why, like, who cares really if they get the 10 seed and like
16, buddy. Is it 15? This would be 2006, 16, whenever that is.
This would be the 16th season. You know, like, cool, even if they get up to the 10, which feels like it would be a massive achievement at this point if they can claw into the 10. They're probably losing in the play-in, and even if they somehow get through the play-in, they would probably get, you know, swept by Phoenix in the first round. But, you know, again, we're probably going to go to – you're probably going to go to a few Golden 1 Center games the rest of the season. I'll probably attend one or two. There'll at least be some juice in there. And that's yeah, not, and there was, I mean, a lot of times we were so cold with the way we, you know, discussed, like, are you, you know, moving towards a title or are you not? Like, just energy in that area around the arena is good for the city.
Well, the ironic part about this trade between the Pacers and the Kings was that Indiana had the opinion that Sabonis, like, not only were they not winning, but they didn't necessarily see him as the kind of player who was bringing people into the building. Now, that's just, you know, that to me is that stance is the product of years of, you know, kind of just being below what they had hoped to be in Indiana and the baggage that comes with that, with Sabonis and that franchise. Because in Sacramento, you win a couple ball games and all of a sudden Sabonis is, they got no problem with him as the marquee name. And you're right about the stuff we forget about with the fans. You know, when they beat Minnesota, I did not do any of the post-game media availability, and I left right after the game, which means that I kind of walked out, quote-unquote, with the people. You know what I mean? Like, the fans just leaving the building. And outside of the Golden 1 Center, there's an area called the Downtown Commons that restaurants and bars, and, it, you know, when you know, there's folks out there, it's a pretty lively scene. And I'm just kind of looking around going, man, this energy is so much different than every other night that I've been there this season. So I do like the trade for them. You know, down the road, A, does it work? B, are they ready to pay Sabonis, you know, $50 million?
Well, and C, like, if Tyrese Haliburton does turn into like a six-time All-Star, like, yeah, it's going to look pretty bad. But, you know, maybe part of their look, they have more internal information than we do. Maybe their belief is like, there's just, you know, Haliburton is at this point guaranteed to be a good rotation player because he already is. But maybe they just believe there's kind of a ceiling on what he could be. And I could understand that because he doesn't pop like, oh, man, that's a future, you know, perennial All-Star. But some people.
Well, and this might not be fair, but he, you talk about kind of accountability for the failures of this season. He's been healthy. So in terms of him being an impact player, he has been on the floor for a you know, incredible amount of time with this Kings team when they just kept losing games. Now, he had looked really good recently when De'Aaron Fox was out, which is what made the optics so tough from the Kings fan standpoint, was because they had just kind of seen the best of Tyrese Haliburton. He had 38 in one game. He had 17 assists, I think, in his last Kings game. Goes out to Indiana, has put up big numbers, although I did kind of chuckle. A buddy of mine texted me, the Pacers lost, I forget who it was the other day, but they
lost.
Who did they have?
They lost to Cleveland. They blew a big lead, although the first quarter
that was
with Haliburton and Buddy Hield, and like, they made a franchise record 10 threes in the first quarter. They scored like 50 first quarter points, basically.
Except that in the fourth quarter, and this was the funny text I got from a buddy, the fourth quarter that my friend said, I would think that Rick Carlisle would know not to play three Kings in your closing lineup. They had Tyrese and Buddy and Tristan Thompson out there, and it did not end well. So we'll see. I mean, Tyrese is going to be a very, very good player, but the Sacramento Kings have, since the beginning of time, struggled to get top-tier talent. And yes, I understand that Sabonis, you know, he's a bona fide All-Star, but it's fair to qualify it and say he's an All-Star in the East during down times, but he's a hell of a player and a guy who is only 25 years old, which I think is getting lost on some folks. You know,
and fits with Davion Fox. Mitchell. He fits with Fox to me.
That's, yeah, you're going 23 on Mitchell. What is Fox? How old is Fox now? 25?
Sounds about right.
Yeah, I mean, and they kept Harrison Barnes, who, not, you know, now we're going deep in the weeds on the Kings. I think this is going to help Barnes a lot defensively in terms of the pressure on the Kings offense. Harrison is going to have a lot of open looks now because of what Sabonis is creating down low. And so I think it could be good. You know, what's the ceiling? Somebody asked me the other day, like, at their best, if they had this team together since the beginning of the season. I mean, I'm not pushing them any closer than like sixth in the West or something like that. But yeah, the ceiling is
play-in, which, you know, there's a difference. Look, if you're a 7-8 in the play-in, then you're should legitimately think you're a playoff team. If you're 10, if right now the Kings are 12, and by the way, they have a ton of road games. It's like not an easy schedule in the second half. New Orleans is clearly good. You know, I don't know if they'll ever get Zion back or not, but they traded for McCollum. I think they're going for the 10.
Pelicans got better.
Portland isn't. I don't think, you know, the Spurs are kind of hanging in that mix, and maybe Pop will just have them win enough games where they get the 10. But again, at the end of the day, it's like, okay, we're talking about the 10. That's like one playoff day, which is, you know, it's fun to watch the play, and you probably lose. They probably play the, by the way, this is probably the Lakers opponent in the play, and whoever gets that 10, maybe. Although now with Norman Powell hurt, the Clippers are in a tough situation. So,
right.
Yeah.
All right, brother. You got the Warriors beat to get back to, you're in LA, I believe. Is that the Hotel Drapes behind you? Clippers game coming up. All right. Thank you, as always, Mr. Slater. Thank you to Rich Hoffman for joining us. Thank you to Andrew Schlecht, the super producer on the Tampering Pod. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back next week.